Support for this podcast comes from Progressive, America's number one motorcycle insurer. Did you know riders who switch and save with Progressive save nearly $180 per year? That's a whole new pair of riding gloves and more. Quote today, Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $178 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between October 2022 and September 2023. Potential savings will vary.
My name is Lily, and I've had hidradenitis suppurativa, HS, for years. I finally found some relief since taking Cosentyx. Relief means I can show up more.
Cosentyx secukinumab is prescribed for adults with moderate to severe hidradenitis suppurativa, HS. Don't use if you're allergic to Cosentyx. Before starting, get checked for tuberculosis. An increased risk of infections and lowered ability to fight them may occur, like tuberculosis or other serious bacterial, fungal, or viral infections. Some are fatal. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms like fevers, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, had a vaccine or plan to, or if inflammatory bowel disease symptoms develop or worsen. Serious allergic reactions and severe eczema-like skin reactions may occur. Learn more at 1-844-COSENTYX or Cosentyx.com.
Ask your dermatologist about Cosentyx.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Have you ever wondered when we become conscious? Because I always thought that we knew that babies were conscious. Well, not necessarily so. We're going to be hearing about a crazy study from King's Hospital in London. From an Irish researcher who's been looking at the data of 450 babies that were scanned in an MRI just after being born. First, though, it's time to look back at the week's science news. And joining us in studio is Dr. Laura Hayes from the Dublin Institute of Advanced Studies and Dr. Ruth Freeman from Research Ireland. You're both very welcome. Ruth, our first story has to do with artificial hearts.
It does. And I think for this study, imagine Iron Man's heart. Imagine a heart made out of titanium with some pipes coming out of it. And what's amazing is that this artificial heart has been put inside a human, and that human has walked out of the hospital and lived with this heart in them for 100 days and then successfully received a donation of a human heart. So this is the first time this has ever happened with this titanium artificial heart, which is called a BiVACOR heart. And it was developed by an Australian researcher and medic who's actually inspired by his own father who had issues with his heart. And over many, many years, he has developed this incredible technology which uses kind of magnetics and a spinning disc to create blood flow inside this metal heart, which can, you know, now be used to potentially bridge the gap between someone in heart failure who's waiting for a heart and the time when that heart becomes available, which we know is a real challenge, and there aren't enough of those hearts that become available.
Absolutely. When we talk about artificial hearts, often we're not talking about replacing the whole heart. So they could be LVADs, so left ventricle assistant devices, where they basically take over that part of the heart, and then when the heart transplant happens, then they take the whole thing out. This is presumably not replacing the entire heart.
I think it is replacing the entire... Wow. The more parallel technology, again, we've discussed it on the show, is this idea of a genetically modified pig heart being put in. But, you know, obviously for some people there are ethical issues with that. There may be other complications with using organs from pigs. And like I said, really think the Tin Man or Iron Man's heart. That's what this looks like. And this has been years of work and tens of millions of dollars of investment, much of it actually by the Australian government. But what they had done is they had trialed it first in Texas. They'd put it into a number of patients in a hospital setting to see how well it worked. So it had been kind of rigorously tested. I think about six patients had it in a hospital setting and had had the surgery and had woken up and had talked and been able to function. But this is the first time that someone's actually had it and lived with it out in the real world for 100 days. So it just brings such a wealth of possibilities forward, because at the moment this has been used as a stopgap. But what if it could be improved to the point that it could be used instead of a donor heart? And even when a donation goes really, really well, recipients tend to get about 10 years out of that heart. So, you know, you need to think about what happens after that. And if you've gone through a big immune rejection of an organ, maybe actually a titanium heart is what you need. And this can be sized as well. So it's quite small, about the size of your fist, kind of about the size of your heart, but it could potentially be used in women, even in children. And again, where you have situations where there's no other options and there's very few donor hearts available.
One of the issues that you have with a mechanical heart is that when, if it's, you know, we have like a million heartbeats, or say a week, maybe, I can't remember. And the constant flexing back and forth is bad for a mechanical joint, right? So it's not a good idea. So they came up with this idea of this, these sort of spinning, kind of like a wheel.
A spinning disc, exactly, yeah. Inside the heart. So it uses this magnetic technology for that wheel to spin seamlessly and keep the blood flowing. So it doesn't wear out the way other kinds of mechanical constructs might. So
and there's no pulse, right? It's just a constant whir.
It's just a constant whir of blood moving around. It's Daniel Timms is the name of the surgeon who came up with it. This person who got it, he was a man in his 40s who was suffering from severe heart failure. He got this back in November and he got his new heart in March and he's doing well.
This is incredible. Really, really interesting stuff. We're going to actually post that piece because it's a really nice piece in the Futureproof Extra. So look out for that if you're a podcast listener. A heart beats 100,000 times a day, Marie's told me. So yeah, okay. So like not far off a million a week. Our second story, Laura, has to do with Sphere X. What is Sphere X?
Yeah, so Sphere X is a mission that was launched this week by NASA. So it is a mission basically to explore the whole universe, which is an insane thing to do. But what it's actually going to do is map out the universe in infrared light, right? So it looks at a different light than what we see with our visible eyes. So we've had missions before like Hubble, and we have currently James Webb Space Telescope, and Hubble, I guess, is still going. And these look at parts of the sky for a very long time, right? And they can look at amazing things and see fine details, where this mission is going to basically map out the entire universe that we can see over a 2-year period. It's going to do this every 6 months, right? So it's going to map it out and we're going to be able to see kind of this whole network of galaxies really, really far in the past. So it's going to do this thing called redshift analysis, where it looks at different wavelengths or energies and sees, basically can measure how fast they're moving away from us. And this can tell us about the start of the Big Bang, which is really very exciting. And as well as seeing this really, really far away measurements of distant galaxies, it's also going to measure the space in between our own galaxy, in these between the stars, right? And it can actually start to measure things like water and carbon using this spectroscopy with this infrared light. So it's very exciting. It's also looking at, you know, our near galaxy, looking for, you know, those ingredients for life that we might kind of need in our own galaxy to create life, and then also going back to as far as the Big Bang. So it's very exciting.
So to see how fast something's traveling away from us, we need a few images. Is that why it's building up those images over time, so that we can see? Because that redshift is the shifting in the heat of the light coming back to us, right?
Yeah, exactly, right. So it's kind of like shifting of light. So if you think of an ambulance coming towards you, the sound sounds different from when it goes away. And that's basically the same thing. When something's moving away, the light that we see, the colour is shifted. So it looks at lots of different colours to basically see how far things are away. Now, other missions can do this, right? Hubble can do this. But the idea is that it's going to do this for the whole sky, our whole universe, right? So we can really map this out. And why that's important is we get a map of the whole the whole universe. So we can do compare things to models, but then also then we can find interesting targets to then point out with.
When you say the whole universe, is that really? I mean, like, given that we are still struggling to understand whether or not the universe is infinite and so on, like, mm-hmm. presumably you mean as far back as we can see, but not necessarily the whole universe or I mean, I guess.
Yeah, no. That's a great question, right? It's like the observable universe, right? But by doing this large statistic and scanning the whole visible sky or the whole thing we can see, we can start to see, maybe we can't see the galaxies that are really, really, really far away, but we can see kind of light from them. We're light from the very start of the universe. So after the Big Bang, we can start to see this, you know, things kind of start to settle down, and there's epoch of recombination where these galaxies started to form and ionize things. And we'll be actually able to measure that with Sphere X, which is really exciting, right?
Yeah. It is something. No, for sure. And you'd be able to, and you obviously by having a movie essentially over those 6 months, you'll be able to rewind the movie and understand where these things came from and where it all began in some respects.
Yeah, exactly, right. And comparing it with some kind of models that we've had, because we have all of these models that theorists have worked on, but we have no way really to constrain it because we have no observations, right? So this is the first time we'll have this huge map that we can actually then mingle together.
Great, because we know from talking about it in this program that models are great, but you really know your model's working when you you run it and it matches what you see outside the window.
Yeah,
brilliant.
Absolutely.
Okay, our third story, Ruth, has to do with dogs and the fact that we don't quite understand them as much as we might think.
I felt kind of bad reading this story because you often read research about how dogs are so good at reading our emotions, and this is showing that we are the exact opposite. We are truly awful at understanding what's going on for them. And this work, apparently it was inspired during the pandemic and since then, when we sort of blur out the backgrounds when we're on Zoom calls or team calls and you sort of see this person pulled out in isolation. So this researcher from the Arizona State University was wondering if she kind of did the same thing with the dog. So you had a video of the dog, but everything else was blurred out, would you know what reaction the dog was having? So she used her own dog, and this is a study with, I think, only one dog in it, but many, many participants who viewed the video. So over 800 participants viewed different videos of this dog in different situations. So the dog was filmed doing things that the dog likes doing and the things that the dog does not like doing, but nothing too mean. So things like, you know, he really likes going for a walk. So when you pick up the lead, he really likes getting a treat, but he does not like the vacuum cleaner. So he's kind of scared of that. So she had all the videos and she showed people the videos and they were well able to assign sort of positive or negative emotions when they could see the whole picture. But then they just took the dog out on his own.
And like a cutout sort of thing.
A sort of cutout. Like imagine everything else is blurred and you can't really see what's happening. And people just sort of randomly assigned positive and negative emotions.
What?
And in fact, worse, when they edited the videos where they had the sort of positive reaction to a treat, but with the video of the vacuum cleaner, people just thought that was negative. So they only interpreted the situation. They didn't interpret what the dog was doing at all.
I would like to think I'd know when my dog is happy or my dog's not. Although, no, I think... Yeah, maybe it's just contextual.
Well, that's what she's saying. Like, really, we're not looking at the animal. We're not taking any cues from the behavior. We're looking at the surroundings. Or that's certainly... And look, this is not a dog that these people knew. Of course, one possibility is you get better at reading your own dog.
Or this dog is not a very expressive dog.
Well, I mean, the other thing is we do know that if dogs and humans stare into each other's eyes, they both get rushes of oxytocin. So, like, there obviously is a bond. You know, we do hear stories about dogs responding to their owner's needs. But it seems like we're just not so good.
Yeah. I'd love to hear what you make of that, actually. I'm sure lots of people have this sense, they have this closeness, this understanding of their dogs. Do you think that rings true for you? You can email us, science@newstalk.com. Tell us the story of you and your dog. Our final story, Laura, it's kind of an interesting one, right? It's to do with mental health and the things that make us happy.
Yeah, so this was a really interesting study that was published in Nature Mental Health, which looked at, you know, how can we improve, you know, depression and anxiety levels, particularly in kind of older people, right? So people 60 and above, how can we do that without, you know, using kind of the typical antidepressants that are typically used or maybe talk therapy, which may not be accessible to kind of elderly people.
Well, they may not want it.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Right? And there's definitely kind of some, you know, we've kind of changed our own thoughts about, you know, mental health and it's more open and talked about, but maybe it's a bit different in the older population. Where this looked at looking at, you know, a group art therapy or group art, even just activities within this older population. And they found that this art therapy, regardless of whether it was music, whether it was painting, whether it was like, you know, film or studies like that, they had a really dramatic impact on anxiety and depression in that population, which was really interesting. And found kind of similar, you know, improvements in depression and anxiety compared to, you know, taking antidepressants or doing therapy, which is really kind of positive, right? If you think about it, that's a really simple aspect you can look at, right? You can include this in kind of care homes, doing group activities and arts. You know, it's non-intrusive, it's easily accessible, and something that can really have a dramatic impact on these populations.
Yeah, I mean, we know that's true for movement and exercise. We know it's true for getting outside, but actually indulging in creative play, whatever that looks like, seems also to have significant benefits.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's things about using your cognitive, different kind of aspects of your brain that you're used to using. Mm. There's, of course, a social aspect to it. I think that was very interesting. And also, I guess, this comparison of being social, right? You're really kind of working with different people and you're able to discuss more so when you're kind of using your hands or being creative.
This is often a social element attached to it, which we obviously, again, know is of social benefit.
Yeah.
Did it mention what types of... Because if when I'm old, I'm not doing Zumba. Like, I'm not doing that. I'm not doing jazzercise. I'm not doing acro aerobics. Does it mention, like, what types of dance or whatever? Or
Yeah. And actually, some of the control studies that they compared this to, so like to compare how much, you know, the arts in particular improved anxiety and depression, included just simple physical activity. And that didn't have the same effect, right?
Oh, wow.
So it's maybe dance that, you know, you're sitting on your chair and you're being creative in some way, right? You're doing interpretive dance. I don't know. But it was really...
Interpretive dance.
Yeah. Now you're talking my language. Yeah. Interpretive dance is what I'm going to be doing in the old folks' home.
Yeah, exactly. Which is also kind of another aspect was they found it had larger impacts in people that lived in care homes versus in a community center, right? So I guess that also begs the question of, was it more accessible to people? Was it easier for people to get involved when they're in a care home and they have this, their social scene to be able to facilitate that?
But it makes you think about like bringing these things into society before people are older and depressed and need them, you know, because if you've never done it before, it's daunting to start something new. And actually thinking about sort of community-based activities being much more part of the fabric of what we do, because the kids do a lot of that kind of stuff. But you sort of stop doing that when you're a grown-up.
Yeah.
And I think we kind of, maybe we need to keep...
Where does video game... I want to play a lot of video games when I'm older.
That's not very social.
It could be social.
Yeah, yeah.
You should need to do some research into video games and old people. Wonderful. Thank you very much, Dr. Laura Hayes from the Dublin Institute of Advanced Studies and from Research Ireland, Dr. Ruth Freeman. Now, you've heard on this programme before many times, I'm sure, the phrase, the hard problem of consciousness. And it refers to the fact that consciousness is a very difficult thing to study in neuroscience. It's not something that put off Dr. Lorena Natchi, of course. She's a professor at the School of Psychology and the Global Brain Health Institute at Trinity College. She was one of the keynote speakers at NYU's Infant Consciousness Conference recently to explore its development in the human brain and what neural patterns can tell us about the minds of unborn children. She joins me now. Welcome to the programme, Lorena.
Thanks, Jonathan.
So let's first off talk about what we mean by consciousness before we start talking about this really interesting study.
Yeah, so a very uncontroversial definition of consciousness is the capacity to have an experience, so a subjective experience. So you are traveling, you wake up in a hotel room, you're a bit discombobulated, you feel tired, you might be having a curiosity about everything that's around you, you're excited to go outside. So this capacity that we have as humans to experience the world around us and from a subjective point of view. So what it might feel like for you might be different what it feels like for me.
That makes it tricky though, right? Because experience doesn't require a physical action. We can experience the world and think internally and be conscious, and yet at the same time, we don't necessarily act in the world.
Yes.
How do we study consciousness?
Yes, so that's exactly the crux of the matter. So first of all, we think as scientists that consciousness is enabled by the human brain. And therefore, there must be things that the brain does, capacities that it has to enable this experience. And in clinical populations that are in adults that can behave and talk, it's fairly easy to determine clinical conscious status by asking somebody to follow a command or to produce verbal report to say how they feel. But the trickiness starts when people cannot respond to commands. They cannot tell us about their experience, maybe because they had a severe brain injury, or in a very intriguing case, infants, when they are born, they are a very intriguing creatures. Everybody who's held a newborn has wondered what it might be like to be a baby. But because they do not respond meaningfully, they do not speak, it's really hard to study them, to study consciousness in infants. And that's what I've been doing lately and been talking at the NYU Consciousness Study conference about.
I love that, you know, it's called the hard problem of consciousness, and you've only made it a little bit harder by trying to study the consciousness of infants. So when if we go back, say, before birth, we can certainly say that a baby, we can measure a baby's consciousness in some ways before birth, right?
Yes, I'd say that is sort of the trickiest, the most challenging frontier of consciousness science at the moment. Some amazing advances are being made by studying consciousness when infants are born. So they are already outside of the womb, and we are looking to see whether their brains are capable for the types of conscious experiences that we have as adults. Before they are born is a little bit more difficult. I can tell you more about that, but yeah, just to make that distinction.
Well, I mean, for example, if you poke a baby in the belly, in a mother's belly, it can respond to that. So would that necessarily mean there's consciousness?
No. So there is something as called a reflex, and that even a severed frog leg will twitch if you prob it with a pipette.
So, something you would hope not to find in a pregnant woman's belly.
No. But also just the fact that there is movement in the belly, that the fetus will respond to a poke or a stroke on the outside, does not necessarily mean that the infant is capable of having an understanding of what might be happening, or an experience of feeling good, or knowing that there is a mother stroking. So that is a higher capacity that cannot be determined just based on reflex.
Right. Okay.
Behavior.
So if you were to do it like an fMRI of a baby in the womb and you played it music or something, it's impossible to infer the activity that you see in that unborn child's brain as consciousness.
Yeah, so with infants, with fetuses, so babies in utero, we actually cannot do fMRI at the moment because they are in the womb, and it's really hard to distinguish their head from the rest of the womb in a meaningful way.
Right.
With the scanning.
Okay.
But where we're making great progress is when with infants that are born at full term birth, so 37 weeks, that's called full term from 37 week onwards, or before full term, so at 32 weeks, so preterm infants. And when they are born, when infants are born, then we can actually, thanks to technological advances, put them in the scanner, and then we can start to really image how their brain is responding to stimuli, but also whether the brain has what I call the capacity for consciousness. So we have learned from adults that there are brain networks or areas of the brain that are responsive for conscious awareness. So there is a so-called brain infrastructure that has to be alive and firing away for adults to be conscious.
Where is that?
So there are two networks. One is called the frontoparietal network, and that extends from the frontal regions of the brain to the posterior regions of the brain laterally. And there is another network called default mode network, and that is more anteriorly. And what's interesting about these two networks is that the default mode network is primarily involved in thinking about oneself. So when we are at a queue in the shop, or we lie down in bed at night, just reminiscing about the day.
24/7 for me. I don't really have to be doing it. Even if I'm actively interviewing you, I'm thinking about me.
That's called mind wandering. And it's completely normal. In fact, most of us spend 2/3 of our awake time mind wandering, even if we try to pretend otherwise. And so that's the default mode network. And the frontoparietal network is engaged in task and goal-oriented thinking. So when we're really paying attention to achieving a goal, like crossing the road in the busy street.
Things we have to do.
Yes.
Right. Okay.
And importantly, though, these two networks are sort of the opposite of one another. When the default mode network is up and going, the frontoparietal network is passive and is suppressed.
Yeah.
And the opposite is the case. And when we're trying to achieve a task, the default mode network is suppressed and the frontoparietal is active. So this ebb and flow of these two networks has been shown in many studies to be crucial to conscious awareness. And that's what we've also been studying in babies.
So, I know we're going to get to the study in a second, but given that we have evolved to stay in the womb that much longer, and our response to stimuli, I just assumed that a baby was conscious before it had been born. And it's really interesting to me to think that that actually is not something that we have nailed down yet. But you looked at these preterm infants and just born infants that had just been born. What sort of tests can you do with a baby to see if it's conscious versus giving you some sort of reflex action?
Yes, so exactly. What we can look at, because we cannot look at what we call willful behavior or intentional behavior, which is what adults do to tell us that they are conscious, we can put babies in the scanner and we try and see whether this behavior of these two networks that I described, that has been studied extensively in adults, and it is present when we are conscious and abolished when adults lose consciousness, we can try and see whether this is present in newborn infants, whether at full-term or preterm babies. But I suppose the background story to this is that there is an ongoing debate that whether when consciousness starts in human development. So there is a number of thinkers and in psychology and philosophy that actually think that children or infants are not conscious by the current definition up to the age of one or two, which seems a bit crazy. But it is a more conservative definition of consciousness, which requires really higher level thoughts, such as decision making or introspection or reading the minds of other people. So really quite complex capacities. And on the other, so this is called the late onset camp. And on the other hand, you have people in the early onset camp that think, no, actually infants are probably conscious at birth or even in the third trimester of gestation in utero. So that's where the work comes in this debate and trying to distinguish which one of these two views is right.
What about attention? Can we not measure attention in newborns and see if they spend more time looking at something new or something old?
No, you can't really measure it because they don't really have control of their limbs. They don't have control of their eyes. So when they're just born, you really
they're just
cannot,
a mess.
They are really like a wet puddle, and people think that they are just helpless blank slates. But in fact, our studies are showing that they are, and that, or at least they have very complex capacities in their brain than compared to what we might think just by observing a baby.
Okay, so how did you look at their brain activity?
So there is a very large cohort of infants being scanned at King's College London. At King's College London, about 450 infants, which is the largest in the world.
Wow!
And we leverage this existing data set of infants who have been put inside an MRI scanner.
Wow!
To look at their brain images and to try and see how well formed are these brains of these wet puddles of newborns, and are they capable to sustain a really complex activity that we know is important for consciousness.
I get it. Putting a newborn baby into an MRI getting the ethical approval for that it would probably be very interesting, but that's amazing that they managed to do it, because anyone's been in an MRI, it's a scary place to be, putting a brand new baby in there. So they looked at these brain patterns of preterm and newborn in MRIs. That's crazy. And what did you find?
So what we found was that in full-term born infants, contrary to what previous literature had found, in smaller groups of infants and with older technology, where they said that, look, these brain networks are not even developed in newborns, let alone to behave in this complex, dense-like pattern that I have explained. And what we found was that, in fact, the frontal parietal and the default motor network are very distinct in newborns, and they are alternating in this dance of activity and suppression that I have explained is very important for conscious awareness.
Right. So the infrastructure is there?
Infrastructure is there. So what we can say is that they have the capacity. We're not measuring the response to stimuli. We don't necessarily know what they're thinking about, but they're capable of having conscious experiences.
Right.
And the same with preterm babies born from 32 weeks onwards, we found that those babies also have, even though more immature, they have this infrastructure present. So that provides very good evidence to suggest that that infants from 32 weeks onwards have the capacity for conscious awareness. We also looked at this in another study that was just published last month. And here we looked at the same group of infants, and we looked at the way that the brain is wired up. So there is this property of the brain organization called small worldness. And this literally means that the parts of the brain that are closer together are wired in a more dense fashion, and that the parts of the brain that are more distant have sparser connections. And this organization that is kind of a dense local network and a more sparse distributed network is mathematically shown to be the most efficient for information transfer.
Right.
And this, the question was whether this was already developed in infants. And what we found is that even infants born prematurely had this small word property. 70% of preterm babies had this, and babies born at term or born preterm and scanned when they reached 37 weeks, had this feature of small word property.
So you said 70% at 20...
At 32 weeks,
70%. So that gives us maybe a hunch that it is a later development in the brain. If not all of those babies have developed that some are probably in the process of developing. Would
Absolutely.
That make sense?
Absolutely. All the studies that I have done so far suggest that the third trimester of pregnancy is really important for the development of the capacity for this brain infrastructure to develop. But they also suggest that it's a pre-programmed developmental trajectory. So even if the baby is born preterm, by the time that they reach the full-term mark, as they grow outside of the uterus, they develop this capacity. So that is good news, obviously, that prematurity is associated with some developmental risks, but the development of consciousness is assured in all of us.
I suppose even without the study, we probably would have known that. But yeah, very good. So what is that? I mean, how does that inform our moral conversation about consciousness, babies, abortion, and so on?
Yes.
Do you think this sort of research helps in any way us come to a moral standpoint on those questions?
It's certainly helping us to go in that direction. So even as late as the 80s, doctors would give would operate on babies without anesthetic, without painkiller, on assumption that babies did not feel any pain, that the babies were simply unconscious. It's unconscionable now to think that. But some of my medical colleagues did this in their medical training in the past.
Oh, so my God.
We have come a long way in thinking that infants at birth have the capacity for consciousness. And then the question now is really, how early does this capacity emerge? And we know that 25 weeks is when the thalamus and the cortical part of the brain are connected. And this is considered a minimal requirement. But as we study infants younger and younger with novel technology, we'll be able to really assess to what extent they are able to have minimal experiences and to what extent we need to really treat these infants and really take care of them in the best way medically possible to enhance and maximize their chances that they develop normally.
When we think of animal models, do we have a good analog for consciousness in animals? I mean, could we understand what sort of frameworks or infrastructure is developing in the minds of preterm mammalian children in the womb? Is that possible?
It's not, because our brains as infants, even in the womb, are very, very different from our mammal analogs.
But so you got to stick a baby in an MRI.
Well, we are developing other methods, including fetal imaging, and I think the technology is going to grow, but we are going towards the first steps to really ascertain that infants, when they are born, especially in the third trimester of gestation, are quite capable of complex cognition, and that we, in this case, they have moral status, they need to be treated with the best care possible, and so on.
It's interesting when you see science and morality kind of intersect like that. Did you take part in this? Because you had a baby recently, right? Did you take part in this study?
Yes. My baby was scanned at 2 months old. So,
oh my God, what was that like? Because, you know, as I say, the MRI is a pretty scary machine. Were you like, how did it go? How do they keep the baby still?
Yeah, it's a misconception. The MRI is completely safe from first off from a health standpoint, but of course you're a bit trepidations with a little infant. But they have this new swaddling blankets now that conform to the baby's body, and they keep them a little bit still. And so what I did is I soothed my baby. I was there and. They got in the MRI and they didn't cry, and they were there for 20 minutes. So it was incredible.
Unbelievable. Really interesting work. Dr. Lorena Nachi is from Trinity College Dublin. I was speaking at NYU's Infant Consciousness Conference recently. Thanks, Lorena.
Thanks so much, Jonathan. It was a pleasure to speak with you today.
Well, don't say you haven't got something to talk about over dinner after this program, where we talked about baby consciousness and octopus sex. That's Future Proof. Thanks to you for listening. Thanks to Marisa Sullivan, Rory Galvin and Hugo da Silva on sound. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. A really interesting one, an old piece we did on first artificial heart that doesn't beat. So look out for that.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.
My name is Lily, and I've had hidradenitis suppurativa, HS, for years. I finally found some relief since taking Cosentyx. Relief means I can show up more.
Cosentyx secukinumab is prescribed for adults with moderate to severe hidradenitis suppurativa, HS. Don't use if you're allergic to Cosentyx. Before starting, get checked for tuberculosis. An increased risk of infections and lowered ability to fight them may occur, like tuberculosis or other serious bacterial, fungal, or viral infections. Some are fatal. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms like fevers, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, had a vaccine or plan to, or if inflammatory bowel disease symptoms develop or worsen. Serious allergic reactions and severe eczema-like skin reactions may occur. Learn more at 1-844-COSENTIX or Cosentix.com.
Ask your dermatologist about Cosentix,